if you do any post-traumatic stress assessment, 80 to 90% of that assessment, we're going to pop hot on just because of military training. No one understands our culture. Therefore, they don't understand the difference between something that is related to who we are versus what is a trauma response. And that's why the research shows that, was it 80% or somewhat better than that, of people think that veterans are broken. And the only difference between a veteran and a service member is a DD-214. You know, you'll one day be in charge of millions of dollars worth of equipment and people's lives, and then they give you this little slip of paper, and then suddenly the world views you as broken. It's kind of bullshit. But what it really boils down to is that we are not treated as a culture. Most of our cultural norms, the things that make us a culture, which is a unified language, art, history, habits, coping mechanisms, resources that we use to function, right? That's what makes us a culture.
Welcome to Your Story Doesn't End Here, the mental health podcast of military and veterans who refuse to be silenced. I'm your host, Rachel, and my mission with this podcast is to be a voice for those who don't have a voice, bring awareness to mental health issues, provide value and solutions, and to change the culture when it comes to mental health within the DoD organizations. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for coming back for another episode. This is our second video podcast episode of 2024, and it's been a great year so far. So I'm really excited today to have Dr. Kevin Cameron, who is an accomplished figure, seamlessly blending a distinguished military career with expertise in clinical psychology and canine training. He's a combat veteran with nearly 14 years in the U.S. Army. He excelled in leadership and played a pivotal role in the global success of military police working dog facilities. Dr. Cameron, a licensed psychotherapist, holds a doctoral degree in clinical psychology and is board certified with the International Board of Coaches and Practitioners. His accolades include the Purple Heart Sergeant Audie Murphy Award and recognition as California's Veteran of the Year in 2016. A prolific author, he is also a continuing education provider for mental health professionals. Dr. Cameron's impactful career, marked by leadership and dedication, extends from international military operations to influential contributions in psychological and canine training spheres. Dr. Kevin Cameron, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Rachel. Appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, I forgot to ask you how you want me to actually address you during this episode. If you want me to call you Dr. First
Kevin,
name.
Kevin.
Perfect. I figured it's usually military people. It's like, you know, just call me by the first name, but yeah. You never know. So, but yes, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. I was so excited when I was checking out your website and all the things you've done. And like I said, before we started recording, I tried so hard to fit it all into the bio, but I also didn't want to be talking for 7 minutes. So I'm going to pass it off to you so that you can share more about your story with the listeners.
Well, thanks. So I had a very unique military career and passage after that. So I got medically discharged after getting wounded in Iraq. I left the military as a military working dog handler. So I got to experience a lot of the other branches of service, a lot of other agencies as well. But after I got out, I started a service dog program to help wounded vets, specifically PTSD. And we did a few thousand dogs within the first few couple years. And actually got really burnt out. It just took a huge mental toll on me. So I went back to the VA and tried to get all that stuff taken care of and wouldn't get any help. But what I had a problem with was that the VA and medical companies were not actually taking care of service dogs. People were having to pay $35,000 to $50,000 for a national average to get a dog out, when the reality of it is it only really costs between $2,000 and $5,000 to get a dog trained up for disabilities. So I went and used my VA benefits to go get educated, and ended up becoming a marriage and family therapist. And during that course, I realized that VA still wasn't going to pay for service dogs, and medical insurance wasn't going to pay for service dogs. But over the course of about 5-6 years, I had helped so many veterans and had zero suicide attempts. And really wanted to understand why I was making such an impact in the little clinics I was working in versus what the VA was doing, and trying to figure out what's going on. And in my time in school, I realized that mental health and therapists didn't really understand how to treat veterans, how to interact with them. And I really didn't at that time figure out why. But I had made such an impact in the veteran community at that point that the VA, through the VRE program, the Veterans Rehabilitation Education Program, decided to send me to get my doctorate. And that was the greatest and most and the largest mistake I probably made. Ended up to go get my doctorate in clinical psychology, you know, so I want to be able to continue the mental health and take care of our own. But in the course of my studies, I realized how broken the system actually was. And my initial dissertation project was to, you know, figure out if there just was a difference between, you know, someone who's been in the military treating a veteran or someone who had not been in the military, you know, and just a traditional therapist, maybe where the disconnect was. And what I found out was shocking. First off, that there's no difference in if a mental health provider actually has military experience or not. But what the difference was is if they had what's called cultural competency, actually had been trained in the veteran and military cultures. Well, through my research, just trying to get that figured out, I found out that veterans were not identified as a culture. I found out that the VA doesn't actually treat veterans. The VA only treats people who are eligible for VA healthcare. If you actually go look at the American Psychological Association, who pretty much governs mental health in the U.S., they work hand in hand with the VA for veterans and basically everyone. And they don't even define what a veteran is. They will define every other social group out there, every other culture out there, but they can't define vets. The research actually showed that there's a disparity between us and civilians, that they can't normalize assessments for us. They don't understand why our suicide rate's higher than everybody else. They don't understand why our homeless rate's higher than everyone else. They don't understand why our therapy outcomes are horrible and poorer compared to everybody else. And looking into this, what the actual problem is we're not identified as a culture because no one understood us. Looking at the research, everyone in research is screaming or has been screaming for us to be treated as a culture. But what most people don't realize, and this is really where the problem with mental health comes in for vets, is that the world is ran by research. And if you don't do the research, then it doesn't exist, right? Kind of like being back in the military. If we didn't do the PMCS on a vehicle and then fill out the 5988 or whatever the hell it was, then the maintenance wasn't done, even though we looked at the vehicle. Nothing wrong with it. It still wasn't done, right? So the people had tried to do the research before, but the military is inherently classified. As dumb as that sounds, you can't go on a military base and just ask, so how many people are in this unit? No one's going to tell you that that's classified information. Even unclassified is still a classification. And most of this research out there is actually being done by college kids, people in university programs trying to get their dissertations, right? Trying to do the right thing, but they don't get it. And so what I ended up doing is in 2022 and finally published in 2023 is I actually took the time and got veterans and military service members validated as independent cultures. Now, a lot of people would ask, you know, like, why is this cultural element so important? Well, it is drastically important when it comes to mental health and how we're diagnosed and how we're even treated, right? If someone walks in a mental health clinic and say, hey, I hear voices, I'm talking to this person that I never see, they're just in my head, right? They're going to say, hey, you're crazy. Well, if they're Catholic and they're talking to God, then they're perfectly fine. And their culture says that, hey, it's normal, it's fine. And one of the biggest things in the DSM is big purple book that says, you know, what all these diagnoses are. It says the first thing you have to do is, yeah, if they have this symptomology, you have to take their culture into effect. And if they're not identified as a culture, then it doesn't matter. So vets were never treated as a culture. If you do any post-traumatic stress assessment, any of them, 80 to 90% of that assessment, we're going to pop hot on just because of military training. No one understands our culture. Therefore, they don't understand the difference between something that is related to who we are versus what is a trauma response. And that's why the research shows that, was it 80% or some odd better than that, of people think that veterans are broken. And the only difference between a veteran and a service member is a DD-214. You know, you go one day being in charge of millions of dollars worth of equipment and people's lives, and then they give you this little slip of paper, and then suddenly the world views you as broken. It's kind of bullshit. But what it really boils down to is that we are not treated as a culture. Most of our cultural norms, the things that make us a culture, which is a unified language, art, history, habits, coping mechanisms, resources that we use to function, right? That's what makes us a culture. But when we go through basic training, it doesn't matter where we come from, right? It doesn't matter if you're coming from the north, the south, the east, the west, what your social economic background is. When you go into the military, you are classically conditioned, pretty much brainwashed into that military culture, right? You're a Marine, or you're a seaman, or you're an airman, or you're a soldier, and you stay in that independent culture until you discharge, and then you join the veteran culture. And no one trained us to be a veteran. In fact, most of the transition service programs tell us, oh, most of your military skills won't transfer. You know, you welcome to go back and become a civilian. Well, if you ever learn to ride a bike, you can't just unlearn to ride a bike. You may have trouble and struggles, but you're still going to be able to figure it out. You can't unlearn being a service member. So when you get out and we're listening to all these people around us, you know, and they're trying to compare us to quote unquote normal people, like, we look broken. And that's just not the case, right? We're trained to be situationally aware. We're trained to be observant of our environment. We have periods of sporadic energy. Oh, I feel motivated to go do something. Let's go do something. Then I'm just going to sit on my ass because I have nothing to do. We don't care about traditional first world problems anymore, right? We understand what it's like to go eat at the chow hall. So we don't necessarily cry if we have to go eat ramen, you know, and it just one of those things about being a service member. So now what I do is I spend my days going in really trying to shift that mentality. We got that research published and that identifies vets as service members. And then I went on to really go take that a step further. Most people don't even realize that the fundamental leadership skills that they teach us in the military are the same skills a therapist is trying to teach you in a therapy session. You know, a therapist is going to sit there and try to have you structure your life. They're going to have you find purpose. They're going to have you learn to communicate and share who you are. They're going to develop coping mechanisms and they're going to try to get you to evaluate your environment for who you are. Well, regardless of what branch of service we're in, that is the exact same thing as an operations order, a risk assessment, and basic after action report. And most E3s, E4s of the military, which most of us got out of, at least beyond that, understand what that is. And that's the culture we're used to. I have a clinic and we see thousands of vets a year. Probably about 80% of them come in with diagnoses that don't fit them because they don't take their culture into effect. And most of them can actually be taken care of in 3 to 4 weeks versus the 12 to 28 weeks of traditional cognitive behavioral therapy. And that just boils down to more training than anything else. And that's where I'm at today.
Well, that you brought up so many good points here and really kind of got my wheels turning. The first thing, talking about this culture piece, because the idea of culture has come up a lot lately. I actually added changing the culture into the mission of this podcast last year because I recognized how important that idea of culture is. And I think I'm seeing it pop up a lot more in books and now from what you're saying, research too. But I didn't realize that that the VA, which it makes sense that they're not there to treat veterans. And it makes sense when you line up all these things and you say, well, this is why there's a disconnect here, because this basically foundational stuff wasn't even set in place. And I don't quite know the history of the VA, but from bits and pieces of what I heard, a lot of it, you know, is rooted in a different era of war, quote unquote war, I guess, than what we're sitting at today. And I don't know how often the government goes back and reevaluates the VA and stuff. I mean, I'm sure it happens a lot, but I don't know if the right people are talking. And so I think it's really awesome, the research that you are doing, because it is incredibly helpful, the research that you have done. Especially when we talk about, you know, the conversations that have come up a lot lately, just in the US in general, talking about, you know, how we treat people of color and people from different racial backgrounds and cultures when it comes to the medical practice versus just throwing everyone under this blanket diagnosis and saying, well, you fit under this because this is what is quote unquote normal, when, you know, a person of color might present differently than a person who is Caucasian. Similarly, it sounds like you're saying a veteran is going to present differently than someone who's never served in the military before. And it's interesting that I've never heard that side of the conversation come up before. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's even worse than that. Service members present differently than veterans. And veterans and service members are definitely different than civilians.
Yeah.
You talked about the VA in a different time. And he goes, yeah, the VA does come from a different time. But I don't think that's the issue. The issue is that no one had done the research about identifying vets as a culture. Because the moment a cultural group is identified, mental health professionals are required by professional standards, and in some cases the law, depending on what state they're from, to become culturally competent in that group that they're working with before they do therapy with them. Every assessment has got to be evaluated for that culture. That's why we can't do intelligence tests on a lot of minorities anymore, because they weren't normed, or is what they call it, for that culture. So that is what part of the driving force is. And the ironic thing is they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot, because the VA and the APA are the ones that basically make the recommendations to Congress and everyone else about, you know, veteran and military mental health care. But ironically, a lot of the mental health providers in the military aren't even college graduates. To give you an example, the Army has a program, their AMED program, where you can go to a doctorate program for psychology, which you could have a background in chemical engineering, right? And then go become a psychologist. You don't actually have to have a background in psychology. Yeah. You could have a background in Russian literature, a master's in Russian literature, and then go be a clinical psychologist. It's crazy. Wow. And the coursework for a clinical psychologist is the exact same thing as a marriage and family therapist, but that's a different conversation. But basically what happens is they recruit these college kids during their senior year of college. They commission them as a captain in the Army. They go through a modified boot camp. And then as soon as they hit the military service, they're treating service members and they're basing it off of their civilian experience about what is right and what is wrong. And they don't even have enough training to be culturally competent. I mean, we don't give a private anything bigger than a potato gun to begin with, just because they don't know anything yet.
Right.
And now we're putting these kids who haven't graduated, most of them haven't been licensed, and now they're providing mental health services to military service members and defining their career. The VA, you can't even go work at the VA as a clinical psychologist unless you've been to an APA-approved school. And that's a joke within itself. Because the numbers out there say there's absolutely zero difference between an APA school and a non-APA school. They're all accredited. One just pays an extra funding fee to join the Cool Kids Club.
And APA, I assume, is American
And American
Psychological.
Psychological Association.
Okay. Yeah. That's really interesting. Because it's one of those things that people just don't know, right? Like those background things that you know when you're in the field and you're are surrounded by it. But I think a lot of people, when they go to medical, just say as a service member or even as a veteran, there's a level of trust there because there has to be a level of trust there, hoping that that person is there qualified and educated enough to help with the issue at hand, whatever that may be. And I've seen on the physical side of healthcare, active duty, how incompetent people can be, which, a lot of that does fall back to training. And the military's form of training is usually get someone through as fast as possible so we can fill a slot. But is that really benefiting people at the end of the day? I mean, what are your thoughts when it comes to, you talked about the homeless issue, the suicide issue that they're constantly trying to figure out, but you also experienced an environment where you had zero suicide. So what are your thoughts surrounding that whole thing?
Well, that's a lot. I think you hit the nail on the head. Veterans and service members go seek help, and we are conditioned by military service that when we go talk to a person in authority, that they are the authority. They don't realize that they may not know their ass from a hole in the ground, which is kind of ironic. And if they're being told that they're broken, or that there's something wrong with them, they don't have the insight or the training to turn around and say that, well, show me the regulation, because that's what we're taught, right? If I don't like what I'm being told, there's a regulation somewhere in the military that says yes or no, right? It's kind of the gotcha card, right? Boss comes down, a supervisor comes down and said, no, you can't do that. The regulation says I can. So they don't have that in the military. I think the problem realistically is, in a lot of ways, and it's going to sound very bad, is us. Most people are taught in the absence of orders, take charge. Most veterans don't take charge of their life. They get out, they go to the VA, but they're given what they're told, right? They don't give everything to their psychologist or therapist because they're afraid of, getting locked up or having their freedoms taken away, which is very valid. But they don't ever also do the homework to find out what right is. It's like the moment a lot of us get out of the military, we just turn everything off and get lost. When the military actually teaches us everything, or at least the fundamentals of what we need to do to square ourselves away, as hokey as that sounds. I mean, when you need something accomplished, you create a hasty plan and go get it accomplished. You define an intent. And when you define an intent, you have a measure of success or failure. If you need mental help, right, what are you actually struggling with? And not, well, I need help because I was told to. Well, no, what are you actually struggling with? And I bring up like things like the operations order, right? Because you can get a situation, a mission, execution, service, support, command, and signal, but you basically helps you break down and define what the problem is. Right. Well, I'm struggling. Well, why are you struggling? Well, X, Y, and Z. Now you at least have something that you can address. But most vets don't do that. Right. They're looking for a lifeline in many ways. And I'm not saying that people don't need it, but they need mentorship. They need purpose, motivation, and direction. They need to identify what a standard for their life is going to be. And move forward with it. A lot of guys give up because they don't know what else to do, but they haven't done everything. They haven't done what their training tells them to do. Their training tells them that seek guidance, right? Their training tells them to develop, in the absence of orders, take charge, right? Communicate effectively, evaluate the operation or the activity that just transpired. And a lot of these guys don't do that. And when you don't have an intent, you can always turn around and show how bad life is, how bad things are, right? And it's self-defeating. The other problem that we have that is really that we turn around and we're taught that there is no I in team, So we take care of everybody else around us. You know, people will call it a trauma response. You know, take the attention away from me so we help everyone else. And yeah, it can be a trauma response, but it's also a cultural response. You take care of the team because the team takes care of you. You take care of the family. You take care of everyone else around you, and they'll look out for you. But in the civilian world, it doesn't work that way. Most people, if you get high enough in rank and position in the military, you eventually have to learn the hard lesson that you have to take care of yourself and square yourself away before you can take care of your troops or your teams. And a lot of people forget that when they get out. And then it's a downhill spiral.
Yeah, I think you mentioned a lot of people get out in the lower ranks, like the E1, E4, E5, somewhere around there. And I think that's talking about the people that'll do like the one, maybe two tours in the military. And it's something that came up for me when you were talking, is thinking about the mindset that is taught in the military in those lower ranks of just following direction. And obviously not every branch is like this. I think some branches teach leadership at a lot lower ranks than like the Navy, where I came from, where like when you're E1 through E4, you're just listening to the other people around you. And so I think about how that translates to the veteran lifestyle, where someone is just quite literally waiting for direction. And, you know, when you join the service that has an instruction, a roadmap, a guideline for everything, and then all of a sudden thrown out to this civilian world where it's like this overwhelming amount of freedom, and all of a sudden I have to take control of my own life. I mean, I know even for me personally, it was like, where do I start, you know? So yeah,
exactly. But I mean, but if you really think about it, right, there's not much in our life that we can't plot out and plan out. And I'm not talking when I teach veterans about, you know, putting their life in order, and this, even this whole therapy thing, we actually call it a veteran evolution therapy. We actually got it peer reviewed, and so it's actually legit. But we talk to them about it. It's not where we tell them that, you know, structure your life. You know, when you're having problems, you have to take a step back. Every time we go on a mission, right? It doesn't matter if we're going to go get fuel for a vehicle or go to the rifle range. We do an operations order. We do safety briefs. We do, even if it's something right out of our hip. And a lot of these guys don't do that for their daily life, right? They don't evaluate what's really going on. And you're right, a lot of us are just waiting for to be told what to do. And even as a private, even as a little E1 to E3, you're taught that if you don't have something to do, go make yourself busy and find something to do, right? Otherwise, you're going to end up rotating rocks outside or trimming grass with scissors or, you know, something stupid like that. And these guys, for some reason, when we become veterans, we just turn it off and we forget, you know, basically our ass from a hole in the ground.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And you brought up so many good points that I think are incredibly valuable. You also talked about the transition piece, too, which has come up quite a bit on the podcast lately, as I'm talking to people who are very actively involved in that process of trying to make that transition process better for service members. It's definitely a huge puzzle piece that needs to be addressed and needs to be talked about, as I think a preventative measure for a lot of these things that we see that we're being reactive to on the veteran side, like homelessness and suicide and joblessness. I wanted to go back to where you talked about the canines, and you mentioned this massive barrier to entry. It actually shocked me when you said that it only costs a couple thousand and people are out there charging upwards, what'd you say, $30,000 for canines?
The national average has ranged between $35,000 and $55,000 for service dogs, and can take 2 to 4 years to get. And once again, it goes back to a lack of understanding, right? Mm-hmm. There's a total difference between people who know what they're doing and they can train a dog, which is great, but it's different than having to use a dog in a working world. And dog trainers, for the most part, are not mental health professionals. And mental health professionals sure in the hell aren't dog trainers. I'm the only one in the country that I know of that has an actual cane working dog background and a mental health license. I mean, it's funny. The people don't understand that that your mood is basically controlled, and to really dumb it down, I'm sure there's someone out there that would try to cherry pick what I'm saying here, but it's basically boiled down to the levels of dopamine you have in your brain. Your brain's a sealed cavity. So a service dog has got to mitigate a disability. Well, a disability is something that inhibits you from performing a function in life, not just because you feel like you need a dog. And if that's the case, if your brain's a sealed cavity, the only thing the dog can really detect in a human being is your stress level, because your pores open, higher salt content in your blood, a different type of odor, the whole nine yards, right? To teach a dog fundamental obedience, right? Sit down, come, be non-aggressive toward other people and other animals, not be an asshole in public. You can do that in about 6 training hours. You can literally pull a dog from the shelter, right? And that's what I did most of my dog. I'm pulling dogs from the shelter, training about 6 to 12 training hours on average. Mind you, some dogs need more, some dogs need less. And that dog is ready to go provide its function as a service dog. People, this goes back to, you know, people just don't understand, right? We try to solve problems as vets, right? We can do this, this, and this, and this, but we don't ever evaluate what we're trying to accomplish. They are trying to teach dogs you all sorts of stupid dog tricks, turn on light switches, things like that. Or one of my favorite ones is turn on light switches and then go clear a room, right? Have the dog go walk through a place, right? Because, and it's usually people like have gone through domestic assaults or domestic assaults or sexual assaults or things like that. Well, what most people don't understand is most sexual assaults happen in private with someone you know. All right. So why would you be afraid to go out in public around people you don't know? That's the first part. The other half to that is a dog has to be able to mitigate your disability. So if you have both your hands and you want a dog to go turn in on a light switch, it's not mitigating a disability. That's you being just freaking lazy, right? And if you're worried about someone being in your house before you walk in your house, you shouldn't walk in your house. You should stop and call the police, right? So that's not mitigating a disability. That's a security thing. And people just don't get it. And they're training these dogs that are nightmares, right? They can do a lot of stupid dog tricks, but they don't actually function. And people get bit, and these dogs are nightmares in public. And it's a whole mess.
Wow. And is there some kind of standard of training then? Because you're mentioning that a lot of these trainers aren't actually like mental health providers. So is there some kind of standard that is followed across the board for training dogs to prevent these nightmare situations? Because I don't know a ton of people that have service dogs. The people that I do know that have service dogs, their dogs are usually very well mannered. So I've never heard of these specific situations. So this is something that I'd kind of like to explore more conversation with you here. And I'm trying to understand, because I know there are certifications out there, like in order to take your service dog on a plane or in public, no, you can't just slap a vet. Really?
Yeah. So
really,
so what the law actually is, it's governed by the, ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the federal CFR, like the Air Carrier Act, things like that. Mm-hmm. But most people reference the ADA. And what the law actually states, mind you, I'm not a lawyer, but what the law states is that a service dog is a dog that's individually trained to do a task or a job to mitigate an individual with disabilities. It is not required to have a formal certification. It is not required to have a harness, ID card, or anything like that on it. It's not required to go through formal training. All that stuff that people do or try to market service dog certification, stuff like that, they're taking advantage of people, right? And as far as training standards, there's really no training standard. The ADA does identify what a dog cannot do. It cannot be a nuisance in public, such as urinating, defecating, excessive barking. It can't be aggressive. It cannot do protection-based tasks. So it can't do bite work or sport work or stuff like that, where it involves dogs putting teeth on things. So it really doesn't have any great standard. The most people use the Canine Good Citizen standard from the American Kennel Club as a base standard, and then whatever service dog task that dog trainer decides to put on the dog.
Wow, that's interesting. So essentially a service animal is like a glorified emotional support animal.
Well, no, an emotional support animal is a little bit different, and there's different rules that regulate those. So to really make it simple, a service dog mitigates a disability, right? Versus an emotional support animal is just an animal that makes you feel better. So if you have anxiety, right, but it doesn't, and even if you have high anxiety, but it doesn't prevent you from your daily functioning, then having a dog would be an emotional support animal because it just makes you feel better. It doesn't overcome a disability. Having a diagnosis doesn't mean you have a disability.
Okay, that makes sense. So then when we talk about this dollar amount, and essentially you're saying that they're charging people so much money for these animals because they're overtraining these animals, or do you think that there's like a little bit of taking advantage of people?
Oh, it's all taking advantage of people. It all sad. Is. Dog trainers, I've listened to conferences all over the country where they're like, well, we have to justify this and we have to justify this. Well, they're trying to raise dogs from puppies. Then they have those costs that incur, and then they're trying to pass it off somewhere else. And realistically, it's kind of like the difference between buying a Maserati and buying a Toyota Corolla when all you need is a car to get you to back and forth to work, right? Do you really need to spend the money here or not, right? And the problem is a lot of people are selling their livelihood to even get an opportunity to get a dog. And to make it even worse, some of these quote unquote certifying organizations that you were talking about or referencing, they actually require that if a service member gets a dog and they are late on a vaccination, that organization they got the dog from is supposed to repo that dog.
Really?
Yeah, I've seen it happen.
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious. I'm not even making this
shit
up.
Wow. So they have to stay in contact and let them know, like, you're taking care of the dog, you're making sure the dog is up to date on vaccines.
I literally watched it where this vet came in when I had my service dog organization and came in, he'd missed he was like 30 days late on some random vaccination for the dog. The certifying company was required by their contract to repo the dog after he already paid for it. Right.
So they don't own the dog.
No. And then was basically shit out of luck. And all they had, and then that company literally turned around, gave the dog the vaccination and resold it to somebody else.
Wow. So it's like a bit of
a scam.
Scammy operation. Yeah. That's insane.
All because people are trying to get themselves squared away.
So what about for people that, like, say, have a dog of their own already and then go to get it trained through, like, an organization that is set up to train service animals? Is it different? Do they then own their own dog?
Every organization is different, right?
Okay.
Like, for me, my service dog stuff is, at the end of the day, it's your dog, right? I've done thousands of dogs, and it's their dog. You can most house pets can do the work. Most house pets, if you have a dog, can potentially do the work. Not all of them. I mean, there's always exceptions to every rule. But, I mean, I've trained thousands of house pets to be someone's service dog. And it's not rocket science. These guys are trying to turn it into something like quantum physics. It's stupid, right? It is.
Wow. Well, I learned a lot there today. I had no idea. I honestly thought, because, like, typically when you're taking a service animal into not necessarily a grocery store, but like onto an airplane, I thought needed to see some kind of like certification or something before you can just waltz on.
Businesses can ask for additional documentation if they have a reason to believe that it's not a service dog, but they can really only ask two questions. Is it a service dog and what is it trained to do? Right. And that's kind of like if a dog, and the reason they ask that is really to protect their customer. You know, if a dog randomly starts wandering across the store and barking at people and the owner doesn't know that's a diabetic alert dog and the dog's there to to let the person, to let someone know that their handler's passed out, you know, they kind of need to know that.
Right.
But airline's a little bit different, depending if it's a psychiatric dog or not, depending if it's for physical stability or not. They're governed by the Air Carrier Act, and that's a little bit different monster. But yeah.
So, I mean, essentially there's layers, right? Like there's the organizations have their rules, and then the service dog, different organizations have their rules and regulations. And it sounds like something that probably needs some kind of level of regulation or something. I don't know. I'm not in that field, but that's really, really interesting. And it almost sounds like it's not set up to help people as much as it is just for profit, which is really sad.
The VA actually just did VA and government, I should say, just put a whole bid out to do new service dog study to try to find this ideal service dog and what the qualities of ideal service dog is, right?
Yeah.
Their prior studies have failed because the organization's dogs were too aggressive and started biting people and things like that.
Really?
And this whole new study goes back to the whole concept of not understanding the difference between what a veteran is and what a veteran's not, and that cultural element. They're having veterans and service members and other people go get a letter saying that they need a service dog. The dog trainers are going to determine what the mitigating tasks for a mental health disability are for that individual, and then try to determine what a good dog is. So it's kind of like going to your auto mechanic to say, what do I need to treat my colonoscopy here? Right.
And this is a current thing that's being done.
Yeah. Wow. They're doing it right now. Like $20 million to study this right now. It's crazy. It's crazy.
That's insane. So the research that you did with the culture and aligning the things in place to actually define veterans, service members as a culture, what has come out of that?
Oh, a lot and a little all at the same time. Honestly, I had to wait for my doctorate before, because in the mental health field, it's about how you quantify and qualify yourself, kind of like the military. It's not when the military, the subject matter expert, regardless of rank, is a subject matter expert. In psychology, it's a little bit more political than that. But I had to get the research published, and I got it published in a peer-reviewed journal, and that kind of what validates the study. And now it's about getting that information out, and that's going to be my goal for 2024, is to continue to get that information out. I've already been able to get out and start having conversations with even the DOD. I have a conversation with the DOD coming up here about that research next month. I've been able to start legitimately talking to mental health providers and mental health organizations and trying to facilitate some legitimate change for us. Because once we are treated like a culture, it's going to drastically change how mental health treats us. A lot of us getting out and in that transition process, and where I think the cure for the transition process is, isn't anything more than a block of education, a block of training. I think veterans or service members transitioning to the veteran culture, if they were actually given a block of instruction, how to take our traditional leadership fundamentals and apply that to setting ourselves up in the civilian world, it would be a night and day difference. We wouldn't be as lost. The VA and mental health organizations would be able to assess us to determine if what we're dealing with is a cultural element that we need training on, right? Or if it is a trauma element that needs treatment, right? So like, for example, if most of us in basic training are taught to react to contact, right? They throw these simulators out there, the blank fire out there, and we're supposed to shuck down and, you know, get low or don't move, depending on what time of military you're in. I'm a little bit older than most. But we're also taught to be situationally aware. So in mental health, we're looked at as, you know, being hypervigilant, right? And have a startle response, because random fireworks going off make us shut down and get startled, right? That's a result of our culture and training. That doesn't mean we have trauma. But that's treated with a block of education and understanding, right? Hey, that's not, that's who you are because of this. And 90% of people are fine. Versus the people who've actually experienced combat or explosions or artillery strikes, they need their trauma treated, not wait in line behind people who really don't have a lot wrong going on with them. And that's what's causing the disparities in treatment.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think they're starting to now realize that there's a lot more to like blanket PTSD than what they had thought in the past. Even talks about transition stress and if people are dealing with that rather than like a
PTSD. That's all social terms. That's all social terms. So there's an acculturation stress, right? Where basically you're transitioning from even going into school, there's a period of stress. Coming out of school, there's a period of stress. Going in, yeah. And there is that, but that there's also PTSD. And there's a huge misconception about what trauma is, what PTSD is, right? PTSD is nothing more than you've gone through or had a significant emotional event that has changed your perception of safety. Right? Either life-threatening or near life-threatening, but a significant event that's changed your perception of safety, right? And it can be cumulative or can be individual. It really doesn't matter. But that's all it is. It doesn't mean we're broken. It just means that we've had a few too many close calls that now we are our heads on a swivel, right? We react, which is normal. And traumas, it does fall in that. But I mean, the first time we drive a car on the freeway, that's traumatic. That doesn't mean we were traumatized by it, right? First time people have sex is traumatic. At least consensual sex is traumatic, right? But after that, you're like, okay, we got 10 minutes, let's go play, right? It's all perspective. And that's where the PTSD comes in. And just because someone is in the military doesn't mean they were traumatized. A lot of these people got to get over themselves, to be perfectly honest, and realize that they're not broken, right? And we as a veteran culture got to stop beating this I'm broken veteran drum and wear it like a status symbol because it's bullshit.
Yeah, so maybe that goes back to a little bit of that education piece that you talked about where people just don't know what they don't know because no one's really having these conversations when you're in boot camp of, hey guys, you just went through a massive change. And you're going to go through massive changes for the next 4 to 20 years, depending on how long you stay in the military and realistically the rest of your life. No one's really having these conversations to really prepare people for that, you know?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And it really is going to hopefully change a lot, right? I haven't met a veteran I've spoken to about this that hasn't reevaluated their life situation. I mean, how much of this is self-inflicted? How much of this is me just needing to shift my perspective? And then what is this? Do I need to actually go get taken care of?
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think there's also another layer to it too, where a lot of active duty military spend a lot of their careers seeking out that 100% disability when they get out, as crazy as that sounds. I mean, it's almost a joke on the internet of like, the golden ticket is getting 100% disability when you get out of the military. Why? Because it's free money, essentially. But, you know, that shouldn't be the mindset when people are in anyway, because then I think people start to seek out certain medical ailments. And it's one thing, I mean, it's a fine line, right? It's one thing to actually have something wrong with you that you need help for and to treat. But there are people out there that don't want to treat what they have because they don't want to lose the disability. And so like, that's a whole other conversation. But I think that contributes greatly to the issue as well, is that, you know, people want something for their service. And
people think that it's cool to be broken. You know, yeah. I have yet to find a single person with a Purple Heart that said, yep, I wanted to get a Purple Heart.
Right.
No, fuck that. No one wants to get shot at. No one wants to be broken. I mean, who wants to be 40 years old and not be able to go play with their kids, right? Because they're hurting. Mm-hmm. And we got to get out of this wannabe broken mentality and stop wearing it as a badge of honor. I mean, it sucks that vets are hurting, and there's a lot of vets that are hurting in many ways. But you're right, having 100% disability is not the gold star that we need.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, I think it's just that people want to feel like they got something out of the time that they gave. You know, it's not the serving in the military today is not what serving in the military was even 10 years ago. I mean, they're just, I think for a lot of people at the end of the day, it's just not that there's no like sense of satisfaction at the end of it because we're not seeing the tangible, you know, like a lot of people aren't boots on the ground in the middle of a war. And not that I would even want that for myself, but a lot of people, when they can't see a tangible something, they feel like they deserve something. And that's just, I guess, my personal perception of it. Maybe you have a different perception.
That's interesting. When I came in before Iraq and Afghanistan, and I came in when Bosnia and Kosovo were still going off. I went to both before Iraq was even a thought. And I think people enlisted at that time into the military for a lot of different reasons. Then you had the war, the global war on terrorism and all that. And then people still trying to still get in for one reason or another. And I think you're now seeing that different generation that's winding down from all that. But you're right. The military is always going to constantly evolve. And it always will, but who we are as a group isn't going to change. You know, it doesn't matter what generation we are. It doesn't matter what branch of service we served. And once you're a vet, you're one of us. You know, you go to a bar, you're a vet. Hey, we're just serve what you do, right? We don't care who you are, what you look like, what species you are. Just did you serve or did you not, right? And that's all we care about.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. I think in the veteran community as a whole, there's a connection there, whether it was combat, not combat, during peacetime, wartime, there's some kind of connection just having served. So that I am super grateful for in the veteran community as a whole. Kevin, there is so much more that I want to get into about your story, but for time's sake, we're probably going to have to do another episode, but you said you're okay with that. So,
yeah.
So for those of you listening, we'll have to do a part two and get into more things because we didn't even get into your personal story, which I'm super intrigued about too. So, but I do want to give you a second to tell the people more about where they can find you. I know I threw your website up early on, but if you just want to tell people what you're working on, where they can find you and how they can support you.
I appreciate that, Rachel. Yeah, I'm continuing with more vet research to see how we can continue to improve our mental health care and our quality of life overall. People can find me at drkevincameron.com or kevin-cameron.com. They can email me there and reach out if they have any questions or need guidance, purpose, direction, motivation.
Awesome. Perfect. And I'll post that in the show notes for you, for those of you who are tuning in on the audio version of this. And please check out what he's doing. I mean, his website just has so much incredible information on it. Like I said, I wanted to throw it all in there, but it's a lot. So go check it out and make sure that you share the work that he's doing with other people in your circle. You never know who needs to see this information or hear this information. So Kevin, last question for you today. Are there any last words or pieces of advice that you want to leave the listeners with?
Just because you take a knee doesn't mean you quit. You keep pushing forward. And I just really want to say thanks, Rachel, for having me on and your show, and definitely want to welcome to this again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you for taking the time to listen in today. With your support, we are able to increase awareness of the mental health issues affecting service members and veterans today with the goal of creating positive change. If you got value from this episode, please take 30 seconds to subscribe and share this episode within your own network. Until next time, remember, your story matters, your mental health matters, and your story doesn't end here.